Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, along with Senior Scholar Richard Salzman with the Atlas Society, doing an Ask Me Anything. I've got questions from online sources, but we encourage you to raise your hand if you have a question for Professor Salzman. We'll bring you up to the stage. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the financial, I don't know if we're ready to call it a crisis yet. They seem to be working through it, giving aid to First Republic Bank. Thoughts on what's been going on the market this past week?
Well, I think these banks, from Silicon to Signature, First Republic, Silicon Valley Bank is $216 billion in assets. I think it's the 13th biggest. Signature's close behind. The first thing to say is it's just awful to have the government bailing them out. Now, I know we have an FDIC and Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, but that usually is supposed to cover just insured deposits, which is not all deposits. But they go ahead and bail out all depositors anyway. So I have long been on record for opposing not only central banking broadly, but even if you had a central bank, the idea of deposit insurance. Banks should be prudent and rational in their capital and liquidity policies. And if they go bust, they go bust. Just put them out of business. And depositors should be aware of the quality of the banks or lack thereof. So the idea that you immunize depositors from caring about the financial quality of their banks, it puts a premium on reckless banking. So that plus, now here's the big thing, too big to fail, TBTF, has been in place since 1984. Those who are old enough to remember, Continental Illinois was bailed out in 1982, and it was the first time the U.S., through the FDIC, put up that doctrine called the too big to fail doctrine. No one really defined it objectively, but the idea was you can't let any big bank fail because there'll be contagion effects. In other words, the bigger the bank is, the more it'll be intertwined with other banks, with other depositors. So, you know, to hell with the small banks that might go under, but if it was big. Now, what would this do? It would promote bigness. It would promote banks just being big. Being big meaning, you know, a bunch of loans, a bunch of assets, not necessarily profitable, not necessarily having capital adequacy. So this whole arrangement, which is supposed to be for safety, right? We're going to ensure the safety and soundness of banking, are means of making it reckless and unsafe and insecure and increasingly taken over by the government. As early as 1992, at of all places, a Fed conference, I gave a talk against too big to fail. It was only 8 years old then, but it now obviously is 40 years old. When the financial crisis occurred in 2008, Barney Frank, the Frank Dodd bill, Barney Frank from Massachusetts, and I forget Todd's first name, from Connecticut, were two people who promoted recklessness through Fannie and Freddie, recklessness in mortgage lending, recklessness in subprime loans. So when that all happened, the Dodd-Frank bill of 2010 got rid of none of these policies, including too big to fail. So I don't want to go on too much about it, but I did find it ironic that Barney Frank, who's apparently still alive and still doing dastardly things, is involved himself with Signature Bank. So the guy probably made a fortune after the Dodd-Frank bill 12 years ago. And these banks are all undiversified. They lend only to Silicon Valley tech companies, worst of all, tech startups that are risky. And they had a standard bank run of, you know, once they got weak, people drew their money out. So just the idea of undiversified banking, I mean, it's banking 101. So why are they undiversified? Why are they lending only in a small niche of the economy? Because the government will bail them out. Anyway, terrible trend. We can talk later about whether there's broader implications of this, you know, whether it'll lead to a broader problem or whether it's a kind of canary in the coal mine signal, but I'll leave it at that.
Good. Well, we've got people coming to the stage, so I will defer to them. JP, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. So we were discussing as reasons why this whole debacle thing happened, and we came to the conclusion that maybe the sheer of new debt from the overwhelming amount of money that was created made banks such as this so greedy on getting their hands over in debt, and when the interest rates started to go up, then and the supply ever increasing of debt, their new rate, which these bonds came out, were big advantage. All of a sudden, the money that they had invested wasn't as much, and they had to sell it at a loss.
Is there a question, JP?
Yeah,
what's the question?
The question isn't it a fact that then it seems like debt is become some sort of like a junk food for banks, in that they know that it's going to be bad for them, that but they will binge on it, knowing that they will purge it with a bailout?
Well, I already said they're going to be reckless if they think there's a bailout. But I would question your view that this is driven by greed. When you see bank failures and you see, I mean, even in the case of FTX, the crypto fraud, it doesn't really make any logical sense to say that someone is greedy for losses. I mean, these are massive losses. You could be greedy for gains. But to take risks that are such that you also can have equivalent losses, no one's greedy to lose. So that makes no sense. So greed is not the root problem. If these banks were greedier, they wouldn't be out of business. But they're clearly not competent bankers. You do get that in a system where you support bad banking. That's what the government policy is. Put it this way, if you're a sound, reputable, competent bank, you know, like BB&T was under John Allison during the crisis, you're penalized. You try to not be reckless and the customers go elsewhere. So it's a penalty on prudent banking. The other thing I would say is you're bringing up, JP, something a bit technical but true. The other reason these banks went bust is they bought a bunch of government bonds. Now, typically, government bonds are safe. So when they bought these, when they put their cash in that, you know, instead of, say, Silicon Valley tech loans, anyone on Wall Street might have said, well, that's a safe choice. The Treasury's not going to default. But they forget that bonds can plunge in value when interest rates rise. That's just the math of bond pricing. And that's exactly what happened. But what does that mean? It only means that the people at Silicon Valley Bank had no idea how to forecast interest rates. So they're idiots. They're supposed to be financial experts. And they didn't know when the Federal Reserve raised interest rates that that was raised bond yields. And in the math of bond yields, that means bond prices plunged. So the value of not only of their Silicon Valley loans went down, the value of their loans to the government went down. So they're losers on every front. But you can see why superficially they'd say, well, this isn't a problem. We're putting our money in government bonds temporarily. Well, they lost a fortune on those as well.
They at least had a great ESG program.
Well, I haven't. Yeah. Yeah, and Silicon Valley Bank also gave $74 million to BLM.
Okay.
So that was probably a good investment for them because they got, they got street cred. But that alone is a scandal. BLM is a fraud. BLM stole all the money and bought real estate if you know that story. So, yeah, they and other corporations have high, FTX also had an high ESG score.
All right. Well, we'll explore that. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for letting me up. I appreciate it. I have I'm not sure if it's a dumb question, but you know, they say they're printing all this money, okay, and that causes inflation. I'm not getting any of that money. I'm not buying a new car or redoing my kitchen or anything like that. How in the hell? When they spend trillions and trillions of dollars and it causes my price of eggs to go up or gas to go up, where is that money going? Because I'm not getting it. They said during the COVID, when they gave the people money, $1,000 or $1,400, that caused inflation? Bullshit. Nobody went out and bought a new car with that.
Yeah.
So can you answer? What am I confused or am I just stupid?
I'm sorry to laugh, Nate. You're neither stupid nor confused. This is a really good question. First of all, you have inflation right. It's a decline in the value of money caused by producing too much of it. Who produces too much of it? The government. They have a monopoly on money. They're the sole cause of this. And why do they spend so much? I've said before that if you look at public finance, government spends a lot of money, and there's only a couple ways to finance that. Taxes, borrowing, printing. They don't want to tax because there'll be tax revolts. They can borrow, but the interest rates might start going up if they borrow too much. So then they turn to the Fed and they say, please print money. And I mean, it's literally that brazen. And well, the answer is, I would put it this way, Nathan. I'm guessing, I don't know you personally, but you're in the same position I am. You're not on the dole. You're not getting subsidies. And so you're not going to see any of this money. You're absolutely right. You're hardworking. You're trying to save your money. And you end up going to retail outlets and paying more because the value of money is less. And you're being bilked.
I'm not sure I understand that. Because like I said earlier,
yeah.
I mean, if I was getting thousands and thousands of dollars a year extra from the government, so I could go and buy a new car, refurbish my kitchen, put solar on my house, or get a new car, new tires, I could see that. But the big companies are getting this. It's not like affecting me because I can go out and buy more groceries.
Right, right. Well, that's the problem.
I'm not buying more groceries because I have more money.
It's not that the money goes nowhere. You're absolutely right that they're spending the money either on, you know, cronies, mostly, you know, special interest groups, big business and stuff like that. Yes. But also they sent everyone home. Remember, they sent everyone home during COVID and said, here's a check in lieu of your job. So people got, now, if you didn't, like I didn't, I don't think recall getting any money for that, but I still paid the higher prices. So those who don't get subsidies from the government, but still look out there and say, well, the system's still based on dollars and I'm going to pay more for the stuff I'm buying. Yes, you get ripped off. That is an indirect way of the government taxing you. Inflation is long been said, inflation is the cruelest tax of all because it's not legislated. It isn't obvious where it's coming from. People tend to blame the price setters. They tend to blame the grocer and the gasoline dealer for the higher prices, not realizing it's the government doing it. But it's a good question, Nathan. There's a disproportionate influence of the spending. It does go to cronies and not you. But everyone pays the higher prices at retail and elsewhere.
Good. Thank you. Clark, thanks for joining.
Yes, thank you guys for doing this. And I have what I hope is not too much off on a tangent, but Richard, in a previous Clubhouse, Richard, you mentioned that you are not for 100% gold or basically, I think, again, correct me if I'm wrong, you favor fractional reserves. Well, I guess until I'm convinced otherwise, I'm basically for 100% gold because, you know, gold is money, money's gold. A man who makes $100,000 a year, well, that would be, assuming it was $20 an ounce, that would be literally 5,000 ounces of gold. You could see it, picture it. And so I guess, again, if this isn't too much into the weeds, what are the advantages of fractional reserve? I mean, after spending years convincing the American people, if we ever get to that point where, you know, money's gold or gold is money, you know, you can see it. It's not just a fiat thing that the government told us is worth so much. I mean, you know, you could actually see gold and see, you know, he's got twice as much gold. That's twice as much wealth. What are the advantages to fractional reserve over 100% gold if I haven't gone too far off on a tangent?
No, that's fine, Clark. That's a good question. Thanks. But for those who aren't familiar with the background, the broader question here is the government's role in the money and banking system. And the basic dichotomy would be a system of free banking on the gold standard. And then the alternative is central banking on what I call an arbitrary token fiat money. Standard is too nice a word for it, but that's what it is. Now, what Clark and I are talking about here is in the free market system where there is no central bank and the banks themselves are issuing money and, of course, taking deposits and lending, all the usual things you'd have in banking, it was in the private banking sector prior to the Federal Reserve being formed in 1913. Now, the sub question within this is that Clark is talking about is some free market economists who are for the gold standard, like Rothbard and others, argue that even in a free market system, they claim it is fraudulent for a private bank not to keep all the gold in its vaults and 100% back the deposits. The other camp, again, this is within the free market camp. I'm in this other part. Free banking is the system that says, well, the banks are on the gold standard. They do promise and pledge to provide gold redeemable money, currency and checking accounts. But they don't promise to have all the gold sitting in the vault whenever people want it. Now, why? They do inform the depositors of this. So it's not a fraud. It's not like they have stolen the money. Now, here's the key business point, Clark. If you are just a bank that takes people's gold and holds it in a vault, and that means you can't lend it. So fractional reserves, meaning there's a fraction of gold backing the deposits, is a lending bank. It's a bank that takes deposits but lends out some of them. Not too many of them, of course, because then they'll have bank runs or they'll be insolvent. But it's totally a rationally self-interested profit motive bank. And if you didn't do that, you'd just be what's called a warehouse bank. You would be like what today is called a safe deposit box. Now, if you open up a safe deposit box at JP Morgan or Chase, they'll charge you a fee, right? Why? Because they promised to keep that thing in the box and never open it. You open it when you want. So they're going to charge you a rental fee. They're going to charge you an insurance fee, storage fee, right? What the fractional banks did was they went to customers and they said, if you give us permission to lend out some of your gold, not only do you not have to pay us a fee anymore, we'll pay you an interest income. We'll take some of the interest we earn on lending, turn around and give it to you, and we'll make money on the difference. You could see why depositors would agree to that. This is what Rothbard and others in the Austrian camp didn't recognize, I think they knew the history, but didn't quite put it this way. So there was no fraud, and there was a rational self-interest in developing fractional reserve banking for this reason. I hope that helps, but it's a bit technical. Does that help, Clark, or do you want to follow up?
Oh, no, that's great. So bottom line then, just to wrap up, basically then you could still, under free banking, as you've described it, even with fractional reserves, of course, a bank run could occur, and that's what would basically, quote unquote, keep the bank honest, the fear of having a run.
Yes, and when I wrote my histories of banking, I found that under the free banking period, the fraction was something like 30%. Now, that's pretty high. That means there was 30% gold in the vault backing the deposits. Now, what do we have today? We still have fractional reserve banking today, only no gold standard. And the banks, the vault cash is like less than 1%. So if you ask Silicon Valley Bank, again, no gold standard, just what do they have for vault cash? Their fractional reserve was probably less than 1%. They had no money in the bank, literally. So that's reckless liquidity management, even in a fiat standard. Now, why do they do that? Because they can call up the Fed at any time and say, send cash. You couldn't do that in the free banking period. You had to be prudent, and they had prudent fractions. And if the fraction went down too much, of course, that people would learn about it and run the bank. But running the bank itself was a disciplinary mechanism, to make banks prudent.
Great.
Anyway, by the way, those who want more on this, I'll just plug my books. Breaking the Banks. And the other one's called Gold and Liberty. They both have sections on exactly this issue, fractional reserves versus 100% reserves. And you could get them at AIER.org.
Great. All right. Well, let's give Ron a chance. Ron, thanks for joining.
Hey, I'm listening. I'm enjoying the insights.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Ron.
All right. Well, let's go to El Presidente.
Oh, man. I miss coming into these rooms. Shout out to Jag and Scott and Richard. This is great. I got a question around where do we go from here? Everyone wants to look back and say, how did we get here? Which is an exercise that we need to go through. But what do we do now? If you're concerned about contagion, And if you're concerned that, you know, that the market, you know, whether it's going to further recede because people are afraid to call it a recession for whatever reason. My question for you is that we know that you can make money in an up market or a down market. And I'm not looking for investing advice, but for people that are concerned, whether it's, you know, about their 401k or if they're, you know, more aggressive in the market. What do you do at a time like this, Richard, with the pressures that we're seeing, you know, against, you know, from the existential threats against the dollar to the self-inflicted wounds that we're seeing from the Federal Reserve? What advice do you give to middle America on how to safeguard their wealth?
Well, this is, thanks for the question. This is somewhat of an investment advice question, which I'm reluctant to, as each person's, you know, risk style and assets are different. And this will sound very boring, but it's very much true because it stands the test of time, but you have to have a diversified portfolio. So notice the banks I just referred to, the banks themselves did not, and they failed. So your investment program would fail as a person if you didn't diversify, just like the banks did. Meaning what? You can't have all your money in stocks and or bonds. I wouldn't even say and or gold. There'll be certain gold bugs among the Austrians who'll say, put it all in gold. That's not a good argument either. There have been periods where gold loses a lot of value. But if you don't want to play the markets, which is very difficult to do, I mean time the markets, I mean get in and out every week or month, which can be very costly just from the standpoint of commissions. The best thing to do is just to have a diversified portfolio, meaning what? That take a pie chart and say 25% of my assets will be in equities, that means stocks, 25% will be in bonds, 25% will be in gold, or you could use commodities as well. There's a GSCI index. Those are hard assets, so to speak. And then 25% in T-bills. T-bills are just short-term government securities that pay, you know, whatever they're paying now, 2 or 3%. It's a boring mix. It will do well or ill in certain periods, but over time, you won't lose your shirt if you're all in equities. And, you know, in any one of those things, you're not fully exposed. So, you know, after 20 years of that, you would have more capital, you would have more assets than people who pick one of those quadrants and put all their money in it. I hope that helps. That's a very brief answer, but diversification.
I was surprised to see, I thought this thing started with the Silvergate Bank that was kind of a crypto bank, and then then crypto ended up popping in the middle of all of it. So,
yes, yeah. And I have done, yeah, there's not really a question in there, but Bitcoin, I keep saying, is legitimate. So every time there's one of these crypto crashes, they're not really sound. There's hundreds of them, as you know, cryptos out there. And some of them are very unsound and some of them are mismanaged. Not so Bitcoin. But when there's scares like this, Bitcoin itself will have a downsweep for a while, but then it comes back. So if you just want to play around with your money and be a contrarian in crypto, buy Bitcoin. And then don't worry about when it falls a bit. Don't put all your eggs in one basket in crypto. But don't assume that when there are these ancillary crypto crashes, that it means Bitcoin itself is unstable. I have come to believe that Bitcoin is the real McCoy, the real thing that will survive all this. So that's good. My view of Bitcoin. Yeah.
Well, let's go to, I think Chad is next.
I'll take a pass. I need to kind of recollect myself. I had to jump out for a quick second. If that's okay.
Absolutely.
That's fine. Right. Thanks, Chad.
I appreciate it. Thank
you. We'll go to Lawrence next.
All right. Thank you. Can you hear me well?
I can, Lawrence. Yes.
Okay, great. So my question is about an event that happened a few weeks, almost a month ago now, with the whole train derailment in sort of East Palestine, they're saying. And there was arguments saying, oh, the problem this happened is because of deregulation, which doesn't seem to be the case. But it got my mind really thinking, as I understand it, the train industry is pretty heavily regulated in the United States today. And yeah. I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on how did that come to pass? Because it sounds like this is something that maybe happened around the turn of the century in the 1900s, but I don't really know the history of it.
Well, that's a good question. Of course, each side jumps on it and says, wow, this tragedy is due to too much freedom, or the other side will say too much regulation. My take on it, and I'm no specialist on this spill, although I did follow it closely, is very intriguing. Plus, Norfolk Southern had 4 derailments in Ohio in 1 month. So at some point, you have to say there's something wrong with the management of Norfolk Southern. But apart from that, which I can't say about, it is interesting. I would put it this way. The more interesting, broader story is the following. Pipelines and refineries are almost impossible to build in the U.S. anymore. Now, why is that important? Because they're underground. And by the way, the stuff that spilled, it wasn't oil and it wasn't gas, but the chemical vinyl chloride, I think it was, that spilled can also go in pipelines. Now, what does this mean? If the U.S. government, for environmental reasons, this is regulation, right? This is the Greens, are preventing pipelines and refineries from being built, where does the stuff get transported? Above ground. Where? In trucks, in tankards, and in trains. Now, this is riskier. It's not only costlier, by the way. It's riskier because the stuff is, you're prone to, Exxon Valdez was a big tanker. You're prone to railroad derailments, and if there's not enough capital investment, Atlas Shrugged told us that, right? The whole story of Atlas Shrugged is the whole infrastructure is deteriorating over time because it's a decapitalization of the system. That's in the background going on in the United States as well. The fact that the whole infrastructure generally is deteriorating and creaky. But I would focus much more on people should be aware that trucks, big tankards and railroad transportation of these dangerous chemicals is artificially above ground because the government won't allow for pipelines. So, if pipelines were completely deregulated and they can build more of them and more refineries, it doesn't mean there would never be another trail derailment. But you increase enormously the chances of these things happening and then having bad effects. When in effect, it's inflated. There's an inflated volume of stuff going across above surface, through towns where people live. The environmentalists, of course, will use this to ratchet up even more the restrictions on transporting stuff above ground. So then you won't get any energy at all, either through pipelines underground or by transportation overground.
Great. Good answer. Justin, thanks for waiting.
Yes, hello. Thanks for having me on stage. As a master diesel technician and someone that's involved in, the transportation systems that are in the United States currently, do you think that we have subjugated our output of work and our standard to a monetary value, and then when the monetary value doesn't meet our standard or our criteria, we want to complain that our output of work is not appreciated or anything like that? Do you think that has a big underlying stake in why these things are happening? And then another thing is that, depending on what form of information you want to abide by, is that, we're under attack from, cells in China, and we're under attack as far as, the administration and so on and so forth. But when an individual has a skill set as their main commodity to introduce to the world and the economic form, no matter if it's through barter or exchange of fiat currency or gold or silver, that skill set is the main commodity, not the exchange in which it's humans actually perform it. Would you believe that skill sets are the number one human commodity that we have nowadays?
Wow, Justin. As I think about what you're asking, I'm not entirely sure what you're asking, but let me just say that, therefore I'll be brief and you tell me if I'm completely off, because you mentioned skill set and money, the ultimate human productive resource is intelligence and ideas, not manual labor. That seems like it would be obvious even to you, although it's not obvious to a Marxist or a Marxist professor. But if that's what you mean by skill set, yet the brainiacs of the world in any field, whether they're in engineering or business or even the arts, are the biggest value creators. And, to the extent that's recognized, by the way, the controversies over IP, what is intellectual property? I mean, these are brainiacs creating software and a whole bunch of other things. And if those aren't protected, a lot of libertarians will not say IP should be protected. Objectivists do. Another confirmation of our view that intellectual value is really important. And that's part of the skill set. And now you also seem to be, though, asking whether that, it's almost like you're asking whether that's monetarily appreciated or something like that. And the freer the labor market is, you will find that the brainiacs are paid for their performance. And I would include, by the way, finance, a kind of controversial position, whether financial people deserve the kind of outsized wealth that they earn. And my answer to that is yes, they're some of the biggest brainiacs in the country. Finance people, I mean, on Wall Street. So I'm going to stop there, though, Justin, because I may be way off the mark in what you care about. Do you want to follow up?
One of the things that I wanted to say is that the output of work, the worker themselves, those that are out there, there may be a landowner that owns the farm, but the worker that's picking the crop may not have the financial outcome that is currently number one, but they still maintain that skill set of understanding what is a proper pick versus what is an improper pick. And I guess we all have mutual nonviolent interactions daily. The only thing that dictates that is a fiat currency or a financial gain in the mindset, the belief system.
Mm.
When can we make that a belief system that it's just human cooperation?
Mm. I think I would say that's too abstract a question for me to answer here briefly. But the other thing something you're saying, let me just say quickly, the issue of the monetary system, where fiat, for example, which is fraudulent, it is really problematic. I would say, if this relates to your question, that does distort the ability of people to identify skill sets of the kind you're talking about. It's not impossible, but it's well known that if, for example, in hyperinflations or the higher inflation gets, it's more volatile. It wrecks prices and relative prices, and to the extent prices are signals to business people and others how to allocate capital or how to hire people and what kind of people at what kind of pay. Increasingly, there is a disconnect between the mind, the mind's ability to assess human ability and productiveness because the monetary system is out of whack. I don't think we're there yet in the U.S. We do have a fiat money system, but we don't have hyperinflation. Hyperinflations do exist elsewhere in the world, and they totally wreck economies. But I think I'll leave it at that. You have a really interesting question there, and it could take hours to talk about. But the real interesting part of your question is how is human ability judged and judged accurately and paid properly, you know, in a free versus a semi-free system? I think that's what you're asking. A really good one.
Richard, you have a very particular set of skills.
Right, is that Liam? But I'm not as wealthy as Liam. Is that Liam Neeson?
That's right.
You're talking about. Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you.
Those are really great. What are the name of those movies he's in? He's like done three of them. Those are great movies where someone goes missing. His daughter goes missing. And
it's escaping me at the moment, but I'm love sure those. Chime
I love
in
those. Them. I've seen all three of them. I love those movies.
Craig. Thanks for waiting. Are you able to unmute? There's a button in the bottom right, the microphone that you hit.
There you go. I wanted to talk about bank runs. Obviously, 100% non-fractional reserve bank can't invest its depositors' gold, but it could invest its shareholders' gold. A fractional reserve bank can invest its depositors' gold, and I agree with you, and I think 30% is the historical average. But I know of several mechanisms for avoiding bank runs. The Bank of Scotland, for example, used to print right on its currency, let's say a pound note. It would say, we agree either to pay you a pound on demand, or we agree that we'll pay you a pound and a shilling in 30 days. That would give them time to liquidate their loans.
Yes, they did do that.
The second one is branch banking, which greatly exacerbated the depression because of the Great Depression in the U.S. because states had laws against branch banking, so each bank stood on its own and it couldn't call on its fellow banks to ship it cash to avert a run or to stop a run. Do you know any other mechanisms besides branch banking and, of course, a central reserve bank and the Bank of Scotland provision? Is there a third way to do it?
Yeah, again, a bit technical here, but yes, the features that a free bank would use without government intervention, exactly those kind of things. Well, we may not have your money right now, but we'll give you that and a little more in a month. Yes, that would allay bank runs. Another one was clearinghouses. The banks would clear checks against each other, and the clearinghouses themselves acted as kind of centralized reserve, and they would lend, but only, that would be like the stock exchange lending to companies, but only because they were legit. Right, they would submit their financial statements and join the clearinghouse. So that would be another method. And branching of banks, very important. For example, by the way, in Canada, during the Great Depression, they suffered as well, a real Great Depression, and none of their banks failed. Why? They had few banks with many, many branches, and it's literally like a tree. A tree is not likely to fall over and tip over in a storm if it has a root system, right? That is the equivalent of branches for banks. In the U.S., they restricted branching because they had banks chartered at every state, 50 different states. Texas was the worst. You had to have like one office. So all your loans would be concentrated in that one area. You'd be a bank with one taproot. You would easily fall over in an economic storm. So yeah, those are all good points, Craig, and I'll leave it at that. The U.S. used to have 30,000 banks when Canada had 12 in the Great Depression. It went from 30,000, I think, down to 20. So 10,000 banks failed in the 1930s. And now I think it's down to 8,000, but that's still a lot. There's 8,000 different banks in the U.S. There's too many banks. But it's due to regulation. It's due to the government preventing, over the years, branching and mergers and acquisitions and things like that.
Great. We are very pleased to have Atlas Society founder David Kelly with us.
Very quickly, I want to comment on a previous question about skill sets and money. One of the things that, you know, I'm an academic by training, and not, I've lived in the academic and nonprofit worlds forever. And I'd be a rich man if I could get a nickel for every time I've heard someone in those realms say, "Why we're smart? How come we get paid, you know, a pittance of what people on Wall Street make? Aren't we doing something really valuable?" And Ayn Rand gave a good answer in that Capitalism, the initial essay in Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, which is, you know, the value of, for example, it was the value of an Einstein in absolute human terms is much greater than the value, say, of someone producing a new lipstick. But the lipstick maker probably could easily make a lot more money because they're creating value for a larger number of people willing to pay. So it's the social value of what you produce, not the own, the absolute estimate of what your skill set is, but what your skill set, the value that allows you to produce in the market. So anyway, that's a point, going back to citing, you know, one of the objectivist mantras. But the question, Richard, I wanted to ask is, we've talked about, you talked initially about why the rescue methods for the Silicon Valley failure and the sovereign bank were reflected the FDIC, you know, guarantees and so forth. But what I'm seeing in the news all the time is worries about this, the failure of these banks and the Fed rescue, to the extent that they did that, are having ripple effects across the entire financial sector, the entire stock market, which is down today or has been down a couple days.
Yes.
Can you explain the systemic spread of all this and to a layman?
Yes, there is. Yes, good question, David. Thank you. And I totally endorse. Yes, go to Ayn Rand's initial essay on what is capitalism. She talks about this paradox of what was it? Why Elvis is a millionaire and Beethoven wasn't, but still a rational answer. The issue on ripple effects, David, in finance, they call it contagion effects, which is interesting. It's taken from public health, the idea of a contagion spreading. The current setup of most financial systems, which is not a capitalist system, is to some large degree deliberately fragile. So, meaning, well, first of all, it's not on a gold base. There's no foundational sound money as a base. The base of it is fiat paper money, which we know is issued almost without limit by not just the U.S., by all major countries. So that alone is a precarious thing. But these devices I explained at the beginning, where the government is seen as the buttressing element, it creates widespread reckless banking as well. So when the cratering begins, and this is true of all financial crises and bank failures, it's natural for people in today's world to say, here we go. In 2008, it was Lehman Brothers failed. They immediately go to the idea that there must be other, what do they really mean? Frauds out there, soon to be exposed. Yes, why? Because there isn't real full transparency. It's precisely because people feel, and this is accurate, that the whole thing is a kind of daisy chain propped up by the government. And so they expect, and they start losing confidence in institutions and start doing all the usual things, pulling out their money. But another thing that's going on right now is the U.S. is entering a recession. Now, this is an entirely different discussion. How do you forecast recessions? I have a business that forecasts the business cycle. In my view, part of what's happening here is that we're in the beginnings of a real economic downturn. And it has to start somewhere. Have the loans start going bad? The last time it was mortgages started going bad. So it's always difficult to pinpoint exactly which sector will start cratering first. But it definitely has this cascade effect because the interconnectedness, really, of the financial system and the banking system. I could say more, David, but it would be too long an answer. I would note, by the way, notice that credit, has anyone noticed that Credit Suisse just got a bailout from the Swiss government? Now, Swiss banks are fairly conservative. That, to me, is more consequential than Silicon Valley Bank, because Silicon Valley Bank was lending to tech startups, which are precarious to begin with. The fact that Credit Suisse, a major Swiss bank, could not get, what did it need, $54 billion? Not a lot, given its size. Could not raise the money and turn to the government is a very bad sign.
Are you saying this is a shift in culture of the, like, a bailout culture?
Well, because in Switzerland, they tend not to have bailouts. They tend to have more conservative banks. So that's a shocker to me that there would be a Swiss bank turning to the government for a bailout. And so that is probably a canary in the coal mine for European banking. I haven't yet studied what the Credit Suisse loan problem is, but David's a question about contagion. David, I would put it this way. We have an unduly precarious financial banking system, but it's due to it being eroded over many, many decades by the government method of financing itself. That will sound a little weird, but my book about breaking the banks, the subtitle was Central Banking Problems and Free Banking Solutions. The theme of the book was breaking the banks meant eroding the financial wherewithal of private banks. And the theme of it was, that's what happens when the government gradually takes over the money and banking system. It has the kind of reverse Midas touch. Instead of things turning to gold, they turn to dross. They turn messy. And the government is basically co-opting the financial system to finance the welfare state. And by co-opting the financial system, they're corrupting it. They're weakening it. They're prostituting it, if that makes any sense.
Thank you, Richard. That's very illuminating. I appreciate it.
Thanks, David.
Great. Let's go to Agent Malone.
Wow, thanks. I just had the thought recently, I guess it was prompted a little bit by the couple bank failures, but I start, and I'm someone, and thanks for mentioning like gold and sound money and things like this, because I fundamentally, you know, come from a place of believing that breaking away from some commodity foundation was a very, very bad idea. And that we just have this fake, obviously it's a very fake, it's based on trust, it's based on fiat. But I started to wonder, like, well, why would they design the system at all? Except that, yeah, you inherited some system, you keep like transforming some existing system. So it almost evolves rather than is a well-designed system. But why don't we just do every, if the Fed's just creating money, if the Fed's doing bailouts, if the Fed's setting rates, if the Fed's doing all this, why don't we just do everything with the Fed? All your deposits are just with the Fed. Like, well, and we've lived zero interest rates now for like 20 years. So it's like, well, you might as well just have it with the Fed. If the Fed wants to give you interest on your savings, they can just give you the interest.
Right.
And then you could have other companies. It could be like MoneyGram or whatever. You could be have these like the same thing that happens now for these poor people that get scammed of like these usury type whatever loans, but that's fulfilling a real need. And it's like we can still have companies doing the equivalent of banking. You can have hedge funds, you can have private equity, and you should open that up to like regular people. But like you can have some companies that just you give it money, and then you know that once I give you that money, I no longer have that money, and maybe someday things go well, they'll give me more money back. But otherwise, the money that I want, like my checking, my super basic savings, that should just live with the Fed. And we shouldn't lend out every dollar that is basically out there in the economy. Like, oh, it's just, it makes zero sense to me. Can anyone give me a decent defense in 2023 why we should have a banking system like this?
Wow, way more money and banking questions than I expected. But how would I answer this one? You're going the other direction, which is very interesting. You're saying, why even have any private banking system? I would tell you this much. I don't want any government involvement in money and banking at all. We've had a system like that in the past, so I'm not just a utopian. But I would say this, whether you endorse it or not, I can't tell whether you do, Agent. That's not important. We are going in that direction. If you think of money and banking, money is basically a medium of exchange and a unit of value, but the lending of it and the allocation of capital and everything is banking. If the government takes over the money, it will eventually take over the banking. It has to. That's what's happening. By banking, I mean they become the lender. They become the, well, that's why they got involved in like Fannie and Freddie and mortgages, right? And the whole thing becomes corrupted. Now, if you have a complete nationalized system, the Federal Reserve is not only the monopoly issuer of money, it is where you keep all your deposits. That's the direction we're actually going. The Fed is advocating that. There are people at the Fed advocating that there be no private banks anymore. So you don't put your money in JP Morgan, you put it at the Fed. And it's at the behest of the Fed and the Treasury to manipulate your money as you want. They want direct access to your account too. And none of this filing of taxes every April. They want to debit your account directly for taxes. And for those like BLM and others, they want to subsidize. They want to just put the money right in by a digital move. So that is where we're going. It is very troubling. It is totally fascistic. It's totally statist. But it's what happened the Soviet banking system, for example, was totally government run and controlled. And by the way, if you know that you would lose your privacy completely, the government is already all over your bank accounts, knowing where you're spending your money. But if they were the sole banker, not just sole money issuer, sole banker in the country, it would be even worse. So I think I don't agree with Agent saying, Agent, when you're saying, you know, out of efficiency reasons or something, why doesn't the government just run everything? I'm against it morally and efficiency wise, but that is where we're going, unfortunately.
Yeah, I just think we have like, I'm sort of just saying, yeah, at least if you're going to have a corrupt system, just at least make it run well. I'm not exactly endorsing it either. I mean,
maybe
two systems, because we always have crypto. To me, crypto has solved the problem.
I think
some privacy. Maybe you can argue about the details of like, is this the best thing to transact in, or how do we improve it? But like,
just
technology is there, right?
Just as the government. Yeah, I think we should move on. It's too technical here.
All right, sorry.
It's going to eat up the rest of the time.
Yeah, exactly. Simon, thanks for joining us. Are you able to unmute with the mic in the bottom right?
I have a moral question regarding the evil of the initiation of force.
Yep.
Yeah, how do you justify... like someone saying, like, why is it bad for me to steal?
How do you justify what?
Like, how do you justify to yourself that stealing is immoral?
Gee, I'm not sure how to approach this. For the person who's not convinced of it, I suppose, connecting it to, here's something deeper. The mind is the source of all human values, and force negates the mind, your choice. And now it definitely works on your body, right? The force is literally constraining you, punching you, hurting you. And but the connection between I want to do this, but I must take action to do it. Unless you can convince the person that the essence of humanity is this ability to, we're uniquely, you know, the rational being, but also the rational being who enacts their lives in, you know, real form, that's the essence of morality. If the person thinks, no, the essence of morality is some supernatural dimension giving me mandates and commandments, they're not going to be convinced of it. Or if they think, no, people's rights really come from whatever society lets them do by permission. I only offer those two for people who would be more inclined to impose their will on others because they're not making this connection between reason and action. David Kelly, are you still there? You want to help me here? That's the best answer I can give briefly. But
thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, David?
Yeah, I would say the issue of why is it wrong to steal is not a primary. We go back to what is theft? Theft is taking someone's property. And why do people have property? Well, they have property rights, and those are essential to living on Earth in accordance with an underlying ethic of sustaining your life by your mind, which involves the control of certain resources over time. And we have a system of property rights that is allows that. And those rights are violated by force, including theft. So we can't ask the question, why is it wrong to steal, without considering the underlying philosophical background, starting with the idea that people have property rights. And there's an underlying reason for that, too. One of the things about objectivism, its whole philosophy of ethics and politics is integrated. And so you can't start with politics. You have to go back to ethics, at least. And in my view, back even to epistemology and the view of human nature, that people exist as individuals in society, yes, but as individuals making their own decisions. The only control they have to get anything done is to exercise their minds. But minds are individual, and minds pursue purposes partly by acquiring resources that enable them to do it. That's property. That's why we have property rights. And if we have property rights, then theft is one violation of them involving coercion, the taking against the owner's will what is his. So that's a very short answer. We could have a whole session on that. I think we have some material on our website. And I'd be happy to forward it to you if you're interested.
Thanks, David. It's interesting because I went at the question from the standpoint of it was almost like convincing a short-term range of the moment person why they should not steal. So David's logical sequencing and lineage there was absolutely right. But I was thinking of it more in terms of, you know, almost like a kid. Mommy, why should I not steal this? You know, it feels good. And, you know, the standard answer, David, remember one of them was, well, what if everybody did that?
Yeah, I remember that.
Not
yeah.
really.
Well,
not a really
that's
good
a good
answer.
Answer.
There's a... Not a bad answer, but yeah, anyway. Okay, Scott, do we have any more?
Yeah, we do have one more question from okay. Kyle.
Or... 5 minutes,
yeah. 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 Thank you very much, Richard. Truly
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
Thanks. Thanks, Kyle.
So last time here, I was asking kind of a question that relates to this one about Saudi Arabia and how they sell their oil.
Yeah.
It's always in U.S. dollars, right?
Yeah.
And
right.
I'm wondering if that's always going to stay the case, especially since the new peace deal.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, have you been monitoring, the Atlantic Council has been talking about this for about a year and a half now, at least. They came out with an article shortly after the war in Ukraine about how Russia and China are working towards de-dollarization of the American dollar.
Right.
And so I'm looking at DeSantis's recent idea about cutting funding.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's actually the best route forward. I don't think that it is, because depending on the outcome and depending on how it's orchestrated, if the war in Ukraine is lost and ceded, would that eventually, through what the BRICS nations are doing, end up leading to some outcomes that might devalue the American dollar?
Well, okay, thanks, Kyle. This is a really good question. Also technical, but a really good question and very interesting to me, actually. There's two questions that you asked, and they're somewhat related. Here's how I would answer it. The U.S. is losing its status as the reserve currency of the world. If you look up reserve currency of the world, I know you know this, Kyle, but others may not. It means you're the premier currency in the world, and other central banks use your money kind of like gold, like it's so trustworthy. And the British pound was once this until the World War, and then British lost that stature. Then the U.S. gained that stature and is losing it, though, ever since it went off the gold standard in 1971. So the U.S. position... for the value, the reputation of the dollar has been deteriorating ever since 1971 when Nixon went off the gold standard. Now, Saudi Arabia and others, this is a vestige of the old that is eroding and fading away as well, I think. Now, what is the alternative? Well, there are all alternatives like the euro. But I think much more likely if I were to guess over the next 50 years, what will happen is that China, the yuan, likely to be convertible into gold, believe it or not, will displace the dollar. Just as the dollar displaced the British pound, the U.S. is shooting itself in the foot and becoming anti-capitalist with every passing decade. China, although one step forward and two steps back, is, I think, in a trend toward more capitalism. They're not in a current trend like this, but they have been since the liberalization of 1978. And so they're a faster growing economy. They're much more open to, you know, mining and extractive industries. They don't have an environmental movement wrecking their economy like we have here. The Ukraine thing is only tangentially related because by isolating Russia and China and India, by the way, the three of them are together on this. Russia, you know, went basically on a semi-gold standard the minute the ruble, they put the ruble on a semi-gold standard right after the U.S. imposed sanctions. So that bolstered, as it would, the ruble. And China, I think, is likely moving in the same direction. So though to the end, whether India joins that or not, I don't know. BRIC includes, as you know, Brazil. So Brazil, Russia, India, China, that's what BRIC stands for, you know, Kyle. If those three countries, I don't think Brazil can now because they're going socialist, but if India, Russia, and China join together in a currency union, then the dollar would definitely be lost for good. And by the way, the inflation rate in the U.S. would just skyrocket, because one of the reasons the inflation rate is being held down in the U.S. is that it is a reserve currency. It is wanted and demanded by other central banks, meaning if the Fed creates a lot of dollars, at least a lot of dollars are demanded. When the reserve currency position of the United States is lost, that means the demand for holding dollars goes down, And that's when you really get a hyperinflation. And for those who don't know, a hyperinflation is something like 10% every month, not 10% a year, but 10, 15, 20% a month. You lose the purchasing power of your money. A big, huge topic, Kyle, but de-dollarization, as you put it, or losing the reserve status, it doesn't usually happen overnight. It happens over many years, but it's happened over the last 40 years in the U.S. Globally. It's a big, big issue. It's a big deal. We can talk about it, I think, in future clubhouses, maybe.
Yeah.
Love that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This has been a great session. Thank you so much. I know you've been traveling. You're obviously still keeping up on what's going on, as well as the longer term picture. Coming up next week, Wednesday, March 22nd, the Atlas Society asks Dr. Andrew Huff. So that'll be at 3 p.m. Eastern. Looking forward to that. Thank you all so much for joining us, everyone who had a question, and we look forward to seeing you on the next one. Take
Scott,
care.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. David, Clark, everyone, thank you so much.